It might also imply that that the Rotsim had to pay rent to the city authorities, possibly, and the city authorities in turn paid the Levium the rent. But I mean, that's the way Rashi seems to take it.
They say here that all the cities of refuge were Levitical cities. They were all Levite cities.
All right. Obviously, the Levium, but again, there was a big difference between the six that the Torah itself mentioned as compared, to the 42, which are not mentioned necessarily in the Torah. They're not mentioned over there. But in the book of Yehoshua, for example, there you have a listing of various cities. Okay? All right. But let's take a look at Tosfos. Tosfos says, Malam Hayasochel Levium, he says, Perish Rotzchim Haboyim Bedorim Shom Sichm Halois Masva Anon Al Levium. Okay? In other words, the murderers themselves, they were the ones who had come, and they were dwelling there. They had to pay taxes in Arnona. Arnona is the city tax. Right. The mas would be, let's say, a government tax, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
And Arnona would be the city tax. And this is the way it is about Israel today.
Yeah,
in Jerusalem, you pay a mas. That would be a government tax. And the various taxes that you pay on food and stuff like that, what they call
New York City.
You know, you're paying the city authorities, for the sewers and
just like New York
the
City,
garbage collections, etc., etc. Okay. The Lord Tamo, so that you shouldn't say Gezeras Hamelech al Halavim the Arkevus Amiron, that you should not say or you should not think, in other words, that the Torah commands the Levites that they have to hold these guys in their cities and not get anything for it.
Mm.
So obviously there's a difference of opinion as to whether they have to pay rent or not. If we say, according to Rabbi Yehuda, then we say that either the cities paid rent,
right,
or we can interpret it as the second way, that the individual Rotzim, the manslayers, they had to pay rent. But Rabbi Meir says, in other words, he was of the opinion that the Torah commands the cities of refuge to provide refuge and not charge anything for the refuge. Very idealistic, I have to say.
A free ride. Free ride.
Give them a free ride, so to speak. Because the Torah commands them to do so, to provide refuge. Okay, all right. Then the Mishnah concludes by saying, "Mechozer lisvora shehoyuba." Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says that if the man goes back again, and he was a man of importance in his own community, where he had originally committed
the
slaying, right? And so in that particular case, he's permitted to accept once more the authority. This is the Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yehuda Meir, he says no. He was not allowed to go back again and accept, an important position that he had before. In other words, it would be like a sign of Harata. Rashi?
A clear opposite opinion.
Yeah. Chazal is Rosh Hashanah. It says, "Im hoya nasi." Let's say he was a nasi. In other words, the prince of the tribe, right? Or Rosh Beisav. Or let's say he was the head of the Bezdin, the rabbinical court. So Chazal Igdulaso, then he returns to this important position that he had. Kishay Yoshim the Yerub Bisas Kain Gadol. When he returns home after the death of the
Kain Gadol.
So as we see, Rabbi Yehuda says no, and Rabbi Meir says yes in this particular case. Mm-hmm. Alright, so Omar Rav Kana. God has said, Machloikis Mishesh, says that the difference of opinion between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda maybe applies only to the six cities of refuge that the Torah had specifically mentioned. Why? The Mar Sovar Lachem Leklito, that the first opinion, in other words, Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, where he says, that they had to pay rent. So he says, the word lochem, that, these cities are to be unto you, right? So that means only unto you as as far as refuge is concerned. But any other expenses have to be incurred by you. Okay? You have protection, but you got to pay at the same time for what you're using. Marsovar, this would of course be the opinion of Rabbi Meir, his opinion was, Lochem, unto you is the whole Tzorcheichem. In other words, you, cities of refuge, you have to take care of all their needs. So, according to Rav Kana, the Machloikis is over just with these six cities. Avol, the Arboim Shtayim, but in the 42 Levitical cities, you know, the other cities that could have provided refuge, the Reakol, Hoyimalil, himself. According to him, nobody is in disagreement, everybody's in agreement that the Rotskin, they all have to pay rent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Amalei Rova, so Rova disagreed with Rav Kana, and he said to him, Oh, Vadai, Lochem, it's all Chachechem, Bash. Says, look, when it says unto you, it means for everything that you need. In other words, all your needs are to be taken into,
are to be paid for
by the authorities, okay?
Right. By the Rotskin.
Right. So, El Omar Rova, no, not by the Rotskin.
Oh, by the Levites.
By the authorities.
Authority.
Right. And the Levites have to provide all basic
all their needs,
necessities,
yeah.
You know. El Omar Rova. So, Rova says no. He says, Machlaikis b'Avoy Mishtayim. Machlaikis is, you know, between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda is only in the 42 cities. In Mar Sovar, the one authority said, V'alehem Tidnu. The Pasuk says that upon them you shall give another 42. So it's Kikahanech. Like the first six that were mentioned in the Torah, and just as Liklito, they provide refuge. So the 42 provide refuge, but they don't provide a free ride.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? For Masavar, and the other authority said, Balehed Titnu, it says, it's Kahalach. It means that you have to add, you know, to what has already been mentioned. And Kahalach, just like the previous ones, Bahanach, Lakotzokhechem, just as the previous ones have to provide all the needs. Remember, this is Rabbi Meir who says that they have to provide everything
in
charge, right? So Avhani, so these likewise, Nami Lakot Sochekim. Avol B'sheish, in the six cities of refuge, Divrei HaKol, there's no disagreement, according to Rava, that both Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda are in agreement that Lo Hayimalim Lehen Schar, that the cities themselves had to take care of the needs, and the individual Rotskim did not pay
anything in the six cities of refuge.
Right. This is what he's maintaining.
Okay.
And apparently,
what was the reason for the distinction? What rationale did they give? What rationale was given to?
Yeah, the rationale is this. Torah says lochem, that these behoyuha rima eilim lochem.
Right.
Okay. Lemiklot. Okay. So the question is, what does it mean, lochem? Does it mean that it's to provide everything that you possibly might need, or does it mean only lemiklot?
Right.
That's where the difference occurs. All right. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, he says only the miklot, only the actual refuge that you have, the shelter from the great ladon, is what is being afforded unto you. But for everything else, you have to pay. You have to pay your dira, etc. Pay your back, pay your taxes, and so on. As long as you're living there, pay your taxes. Whereas Rabbi Meir is of the opinion that, what do you mean lochem? Lochem means whatever basic needs you have, not just shelter, but everything else, the Levites are obligated, because it's their cities, so they are obligated to take care of it for you, and you don't have to pay anything else.
But if they're in the six cities of refuge, there's no question about that they don't pay anything.
That's according to Rava, right?
They both agreed, you say.
According to Rava's interpretation, right. At the beginning in the Mishnah, they are in disagreement. But then the Gemara wants to analyze it, so as we see, there's a difference of opinion between Rav Kana and Rava as to where the disagreement between the two of them is. And Rava comes to the conclusion that we just finished, that in the six cities, everybody's agreed that all their needs have to be provided
for. That's what I'm saying.
But it's in the 42, the cities, that there could be a difference of opinion between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir.
Okay.
Now, finally, the second chapter continues and concludes with the idea about he goes back to whatever position of authority he had. Remember?
Yeah, right.
All right. So, Toda Rabbanan, our sages thought, David, I think that you're still under the Israeli time.
Yeah. Okay, I heard everything that you said. I've been absorbing.
Okay.
Because it's fairly, you know, it's interesting to follow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting to follow. It's not, for me anyhow, it's not terribly difficult.
Right,
guess,
right.
You know,
okay.
Immodest, but, you know,
yeah.
I think I can grasp it. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
You got still
no problem.
From,
no problem.
From jet lag.
Yeah, I know.
Believe
but,
me.
You know, you don't know how.
Having gone back and forth to Israel,
a lot of by, I would say, gee, you know, what is the group studying now? What's it like?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And
right.
Well, we made progress.
What are we doing? Did the weather prevent them getting together? And this kind of thing.
Only one night.
One
we canceled
night.
That.
One night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I still have charata because
right.
Still bothers me that I canceled out that night.
Oh, that yeah. Okay.
Sorry,
I'll try to
all
get
right.
More attention.
Satana okay. Rabbanan.
Right.
Sages taught us that Mishovil Mishpato Vialachuzas of Yisov Yeshua. Okay. Here the Pasuk is talking about the end of Ayikwa, you know, Parsha Bahar. Over there they speak about the Eved Ivri, okay?
Yeah.
Guy sells himself to be a slave because never he can't have a panasa, okay?
He can't
have a panasa, so he'd rather sell his services as a slave, you know, to a balabas and so on. And then what happens? Well, okay. He can sell the services, by the way, for any length of time that he wants. I mean, this is understood. You see, it's different than the case of Mishpatim. Mishpatim over there, we're dealing with what we call with Nimka Bevesdin. In other words, he stole,
yeah,
squandered
prepaid.
Whatever he had stole, couldn't pay it back. So in that particular case, then he has to be sold by the Bezdin as a slave in order to fulfill, right, to pay back what he owes, what he stole.
Okay. Does the slave get wages?
Well, they have to figure how much his services are worth on an annual basis. That they have to figure out.
So basically then it is wages.
Right. Yeah, you can consider it. Of course, I mean, the owner has certain obligations. He has to not only take care of the slave, but he also has to take care of his family as well. And, you know, also Mora in Kedushin. If you remember, we learned over there that, you know, if he was accustomed to living well, high on the hog, as we would say sometimes, so the boss had to keep him in that condition. So, all right. But finally what happens, let's say Yovel comes, or he has completed the amount of time that he has to put into work, okay? Or the possibility is always, you know, that maybe some of his kinsmen will get together, pay out, so that he can be freed from his obdus. After all, it's a very mild form of obdus, but nevertheless, it's not, you know, the kind of a life that a Jew should be living.
Mm-hmm.
As the Gemara says in Kiddushin, right, if you remember, Kibli b'nei Yisrael avodim, because the children of Israel are my servants, and they say they are my servants, says the Rebbeinu Shalom, but they should not be avodim la'avodim, you know.
Slaves to slaves.
Slaves to slaves, right. So, that being the case, the Pasuk then says in Vayikra over there, Vishova Mishmato, that he is to return unto his family, V'elachuz es avosov yeshuv, and he is to return to the possession of his ancestors, okay? To what they had owned, okay? To what they had possessed. So, the Gemara wants to know, how do we interpret this? So we have a difference of opinion. Mishpachto hu shav, v'yeinu shav, l'mashach hazikah v'yisav, divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Here, Rabbi Yehuda takes a very strict view. And he says that he can be, he returns to his family. But Eino Shav, the Mashiach Hazikah, he does not return to that which his family had possessed before. In other words, he does not return now to the same gedula, so to speak, that he had prior to this. Okay? Divri Rabbi Yehuda, these are the words of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Meir Omer, but Rabbi Meir disagrees and he says, Af hu shov l'moshech hazik l'aveitzov. Okay? He is entitled to go back to that which his ancestors had. In other words, whatever position of importance, not just you know the property that they had, but any position of importance that they had, he also has to go back to. Okay.
Well, you interpret it as
they had
not only
held
the
on
property,
to,
but also the office.
Yeah, la hachazik. Yeah, I mean the idea of the sroor is going to be compared to it. Okay. Mm-hmm. But here
okay,
they were talking about really, you know, the possessions, but also, you know, possessions create a position of authority too. Obviously, if a person is a Zareicha Balabos, as we would say, he owns a lot of property in town, so naturally he's seemed to be one of the important people in the town,
right.
Okay?
I understand.
Yeah. Okay. So, All right. So, Rabbi Meir Omer, then it says, Abhushov the Mashem Tzirovsov. And what is the meaning of Elachuzas Avosov? Right? It says that expression means Ka'avosov, that just as his ancestors had a position of authority, this is how Rashi understands. You take a look. The Mashechuzzeku Avosov. You see that? You don't think that's physical, but he read it as buchsical. But it's the same idea. You take a look over there, roughly about 8 lines down. Okay?
Yeah.
It says, Sefer de Milse, and so the Mashal, sorry, so it says, Lisrora. In other words, to a position of authority. And then he explains, Elachuzah Zavisov, that means Ka'avosov, just like his ancestors. Sefer de Milse de Rabbi Meir, he. In other words, this is the concluding idea of Rabbi Meir.
Sure,
maybe Rayel in Vorov, and he brings proof for what he has to say, namely that he's entitled to go back again to the position and points that he had. Mesoif HaMikra, from the concluding part of the Pasek, Shechozel Gulaso, that he goes back again to whatever Gudula, whatever, you know, high position he had prior to that, he returns to it. Okay? Shenemar, because the pasuk says Ve'elachuzas Avosov, which means El Kol Cheskas Avosov. In other words, everything that was the chazaka. You understand? Whatever was, you know, traditionally held by Avosov, by his father. So from this, Rabbi Meir says that not just that he goes back to the family, but it means actually he goes back to whatever gedula the family possesses. That's how Rabbi Meir. Okay? And the Gemara now concludes this chapter by saying, Mechain Begoyle. And likewise, if a person who has to go into exile, always the Ratzeah, has to go into exile. Kishahu Omer Yoshua, you know, it's written over there, the Afrimos, Hakoin Agodol. Remember that after the death, so Yoshua, you know, he can return Rotsen. Again, right? So the question is, what is the word Yeshua? So he says, this is the rabbi says, Ritzayah. This is in order to include also the person who had committed manslaughter. Okay? In other words, he too can go back to what? To the position of authority that he had before. Remember, we said that this was Rabbi Meir's opinion.
Right.
Okay. My v'chein begoylet, and they say, all right, now, why does it say, and likewise, the person going to exile? Kidatanya, as we have learned, it says Yoshua Rotseach Eletz Achuzaso, right? That the Rotseach is to go back to the land of his possession. Laeres Achuzaso Hushov, right? So he returns to the land that he had owned before, but Vieno Shav Lamashav Ezekabesov, but he does not return to whatever important position his ancestors had held before. Divri Rabbi Yehuda, this is Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. But Rabbi Omer, he says, Avushav Lamashach Zikar Besa. he does return to that which his ancestors had previously possessed. Why? Because he says, Gomar Shiva Shiva Mehasa. When it says Gomar over here, it means that it's a kind of an expression that is very often used with the proof that we call it Gezeira Shava. In other words, if you see something in case A which strikingly resembles case B as far as the language is concerned, then in that particular case you say that just as case A says this, so case A can be assumed to say the same. Of course, I've told you time and again, the Gezeira Shava only works if there is a tradition that this is Taka a Gezeira Shava. You can't simply take the word S and say, look, the word S, I mean, the word S occurs thousands and thousands of times. So that by itself means nothing. But he's basing it, of course, on the idea of Yoshuv, right? You know, to return. The idea of turning, there it said Vishov El Mishpachto, and here it says Yoshuv. So just as over there, we've already proved, according to Rabbi Meir, that he's allowed to go back to that which his ancestors had possessed once he's freed as a slave and is able to go back again home. So likewise, the goyle, person who has been in exile because of having committed manslaughter, he too, when he goes back again home, not only is he allowed to go back home, but he's also, according to Rabbi Meir, entitled also to go back to whatever position of authority he had. Whereas, as we said, Rabbi Yehuda disagrees with Rabbi
Meir. I guess a long time ago, we determined that when the Kohen Gadol dies, and the Tzea is free to leave from the Mikvah, that the Rodev Dam is no longer permitted to pursue
him.
Oh, definitely not.
The Goel Adam.
Okay, fine.
I mean, that would be murder.
Right, okay.
Just as you're not allowed to kill the Rotzeach as long as the Rotzeach is within the boundary of the Ir HaMikvah. But you missed, there's a whole discussion about the tree on the boundary, whether the branches go here or the branches go there. And so that's already a different story. But we finally determined that even though there's a difference of authorities, you know, as to which way the tree is it the branches that are the determining factor, or is the fact that the tree itself is standing within the tefillin, within the boundary of the Ir HaMikvah, that gives him shelter and so on. Because one suggestion was, you know, that maybe the Goel Adam could climb up on the tree and, you know, kill him or shoot arrows at him or throw stones at him or something like that. But we determined in the end that finally Miklot is Miklot, he's entitled to it.
But the person himself would be within the boundaries, so even, I mean, if the Goel Adam.
Yeah, but what if he, for example, the tree had it. The branch was outside, okay?
Yes, okay.
Even though the tree was inside, and he was sitting underneath the branch.
Or maybe
he had climbed up on the branch.
The Rotzeach was sitting underneath the branch.
Right. Yeah.
Okay,
right. Would he give him shelter or not?
Right. Good question.
Because if the branch is outside, then in that case, we could hold the opinion, you know, that...
He's outside.
Tough luck, he's outside, right.
But then you say, well, the roots of the tree are inside.
Right, even though the roots of the tree are inside.
The branches are also considered inside.
Yeah.
Good question.
Right.
Very good.
Okay, so, Hadron Aloch, Elohim HaGolem, we have now concluded this chapter of Elohim HaGolem, and now we start the third and final chapter of Marcos. It so happens that this is as big as the two previous chapters put together.
Really?
But nevertheless, we're at the halfway mark right now.
Third chapter.
Yeah. We've already passed the halfway mark. It's like,
when did we begin?
When did we begin again?
I
think it was in the spring last year, wasn't it? Pretty sure it was the spring.
We started right after
when we finished, when we finished Tynus, so then we started this. No.
Springtime.
Okay. All right. So, the new Mishnah speaks about the Elohein Alokin. These are people who are going to get Malkos as their punishment. Okay? So Rashi immediately makes the following comment, and let's take a look at Rashi. He says, Elo, he says, Lab Davka. says this, not necessarily that this is an all-inclusive list. The Tanna v'Shiur, because the Tanna teaches what he wants to stress, but he, other things that he didn't want to, he did not want to stress over here, simply he left it out. That's what we mean by Tanna v'Shiur. In other words, the things that he didn't mention over here in addition, okay? Because as Rashi, Lokin Tuva, you have lots and lots of other cases where a guy could get Malkus. So Ela Tana Chayve Krista, I'm still reading the Rashi, he says, but rather the Mishnah wanted to stress over here that people are guilty and deserve the punishment of Krisas. Now what do we mean by Krisas? Krisas of course means B'nichvasa HaNefeshahi. Okay? That soul is to be cut off from the people of Israel. What exactly is the punishment of Koris? Well, we know that this is always administered by the Beis Din Shalmala, okay?
Yeah.
But
the heavenly
court. Right, the heavenly court has to be, this is something. Usually the Ramah is like premature death, or Aririm Yiyu, in other words, they are to die childless or something like that. Of course, it's not to mean that any person who dies childless is automatically suffering.
Chas
v'shalom. Don't want to imply that. But, it's a possible indication, that's all. So, he says, over here, Chayve Krisus la'ashmi inon, in order to let us understand that the Yesh Malka is b'chayve Krisus, that those who deserve krisis can also what? Receive malchus. So that's the first statement that Rashi makes. And then he goes into some of the other cases we'll be going into over there. He says, Vatana Almonu Grusha, and as far as the law concerning that the Kohen, who can he marry? He can marry an Almonu, but he cannot marry a Grusha. But what about a Kohen Gadol?
He
can't marry either an Almanu or a Grusha, right? Okay, so he says they learned that one, Lashmi Inun, in order to teach us that Almanu and Grusha chayev aleha mishtum shtei shemas. We'll see. For that, he deserves double malchus because he has actually committed two different offenses in this particular case. Okay? The Tana Teva Lamaisa Rishon, and then afterwards they're going to list that a person who eats tevel. Tevel is untied food in Eretz Israel. In other words, they didn't take any trumas and maizbis, okay? Or he eats maizah rishon. In other words, this goes to the Levi, right? Shelo nitla trumoso, but he did not remove the trumo from it. He's supposed to take also 1/60th of that and give that
to the
Kohen, right? The lo meforish lehu did to the hedya, because he says this was not learned specifically in the Torah that this is deserving of malchus. V'chein hekdesh shelo niftan. Likewise, if you let's say make use of something which has been dedicated to the Beis Hamikdash, could be an animal, could be an implement, whatever it is, that you give, and then you use it without having redeemed it, because the law is that if you redeem it, in other words, you pay the value of the object and add another 20% to it, the chomish, right? Then in that particular case, it automatically goes out again to chulin, as we say. In other words, it loses its sanctity and you can make use of it.
Right.
Okay? But this is hektish and he made use of it. This is what we call me'ila. Okay? That he made use of it even though it had not been redeemed from the temple treasury. So he says, well, either the Tana Hekdesh, Tana Maaseh Sheni, and as much as he teaches Hekdesh, so he's also going to teach Maaseh Sheni, the Hedya, specifically the Tavayu, Malkus Didhu, Mishum Chusvei Pidiyo, because both of them, really, why are they getting Malkus? Because they could have redeemed, and they didn't, right? The Chayim Beruban, says Rashi, and likewise, in the most of the cases that are mentioned over here in the Mishnah, Yesh Tavachadish, there's something new that is there, and that's the reason why Malkus. In other words, you cannot say that he gets Malkus simply on the basis of a general rule, but he gets Malkus because in each and every case something is there that makes him liable to it. But don't try to draw an analogy between one type of a violation and another type of a violation. to a certain extent, we've had a similar discussion of this in the past. It occurred in Kedushin, for example. And there, if you remember, one of the basic problems that they discussed was a difference between Rabbi Akiva and the other sages as far as what we call Chayve Krisus versus Chayve Lavin. Okay? Chayve Krisus means that if you violate the law where it says that the punishment is going to be that you get kores for it, then in that particular case you are also subject to malchus. Okay? But if it's Chayve Lavin, then you don't get kores for that, but you only get malchus for that. So this, to a certain extent, will probably figure in again over here. Okay. All right. Anyway, getting back to the text now. All right. They now start in with a list of people, you know, who are going to get krisus, as Rashi explains.
Right.
They'll get kores, but also they get malchus as a punishment. The first case is habal achosay. Right? The person has intercourse with his sister, right? Or the achis aviv, or his father's sister, in other words, his aunt, right? The al achis imoy, or his mother's sister.
The other aunt.
Of course, I have to point out to you, I don't know if you remember, but if you take a look at the list that we have in Sefer Vayikra over there, a man is permitted to marry his niece.
Yeah.
But a man is not permitted to marry his aunt, whether it's his mother's sister or his father's sister. Okay? That is a violation. Because it's written, Deidos Kahi, she is your aunt, and so on and so, therefore, you
right.
know.
You can marry your first cousin.
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. You can marry your first cousin. Well, there is a possibility, of course, that the both of them had some genetic difficulty. That the, huh? Yeah, but nevertheless, it's been done.
Yeah.
It's been done for generations. It's been done for generations. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I had a sister who married a first cousin. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Rabbi Garen married his first cousin.
Yeah. Many, many,
that
many.
I know it's
many,
possible. It's possible.
Kids. Yes, he did.
But according to the law of the Torah, there's no question it's permitted. Some of the states have outlawed it. So you'd have to pick the right state to get married.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I thought.
Yeah, some states did. I mean, because it's prohibited according to Goyish law. And they simply follow Goyish law in this respect.
You know there's a Goyish law against it?
Yeah. There's a Catholic law against
it.
Oh, okay.
Catholic? Catholic. No, not a civil law.
No, but some of the civil legislation, you see, follows what the goyim have to say. Let's be aware of that. Sometimes I wish that the Besdin, that not the Besdin, but that the high courts in Israel would follow Jewish law. They don't. They're doing everything to subvert Jewish law in many cases.
Unfortunately, just had this right to die case, which really goes against pekuach nefesh.
Of course,
but it follows the law here.
Yeah,
it's an adult man who decided he didn't want to. He read it in the newspapers.
Yeah.
Adult man, the airline Air Force pilot. He's 47. He had Lou Gehrig's disease, and he didn't want to. When the time came to be connected to
to when
life
support
systems, and the court said he's an adult and he knows his own mind, and we're going to let him have his will. Actually, that wasn't a high court decision; that was a district court judge.
But I assume that it would have been appealed. Probably the high court would probably also have sustained it. I would think, because they go on the basis of in America it's okay, then that's the law for us. You know? It's okay in England. It was all right in Turkey.
I am pretty confident you're right.
Yeah.
But pekuach nefesh wasn't even brought up. I mean, it wasn't consideration in there.
So first of all, we see you're not allowed to have intercourse with your sister. That's number one. Right. Likewise, not with your aunt, whether she is the father's sister or the mother's sister. And then the al-achos ishto, if you have intercourse with your wife's sister, okay, Yal Eshes Achiv, or your brother's wife, okay, Yal Eshes Achi Aviv, likewise the wife of your father's brother, in other words your uncle's wife, Yal Hanida, and likewise you would get Kores and also Malkus if you had intercourse with a woman while she was still menstruating, okay. Of course, Tito is more than just, you know, during the period. It means also during the period until, you know, she's had a chance to count the days of being clean and going in the mikveh. Okay? All right. So, I do want to comment. I mean, they don't mention it over here. But we learned that there are two exceptions to the couple of things that we said over here. Exception number one is in the case of the wife's sister. Torah is very clear where it says, you know, that you're not allowed to take a sister, right?
While she's
living. Litzror, right, legalose so oleho bichayeho, which means as long as, you know, your wife is allowed, then even if you divorce her, you're not allowed to marry your wife's sister, okay? But the implication is, you know, that, you know, if the wife dies, then in that case, he is permitted, you know, to marry the wife's sister.
Yaakov did it.
Yeah, Yaakov you can't go on because he married two sisters at the same time.
Yeah.
Okay. But I'm talking about many, many other people, you know, who, you know, after the wife died, they decided, you know, that they would marry the wife's sister. For one thing, I mean, you have to realize, the wife's sister presumably felt very close to her sister, and she, if there are children, for example, you know, she feels a kinship
bond, right.
And so on. There's a bond over there. Yeah. So, yes.
Isn't that a shot in their lifetime?
Yeah, I said, b'chayeha. As long as the wife is alive, he's not allowed to have any intercourse with her, he's not allowed to marry her or anything like that, okay? The other one, of course, where it says, you know, the brother's wife. But we know that there is an exception to it, and that is, of course, the business about Yibum.
Oh, right.
Okay?
Right.
In other words, you know, if he had died without any children,
right.
So then in that case, there is a moral obligation for his brother, you know, to marry the widow. But, you know, if he doesn't want to do it, or if she doesn't want him, and so on, you know, so then you have what we call chalitza, you know, in order to release him.
Okay.
Now, if she has chalitza, then there's no question that he can't have anything more to do with her from that point on. You know, he can't marry her or anything like that. So, okay.
I was,
yes.
I want to ask a question, because in the Torah itself, some of these were punishable by death, but now it seems as if the Talmud has come and made the punishment.
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad you raised the point. Of course, remember that a death penalty, strictly speaking, cannot be imposed unless the people who were guilty of the transgression had been warned,
right,
that they are violating a law in the Torah, and also that the punishment for such violation would be this and this. Okay. So that if that's, you know, not there, then in that particular case, what are you going to do with it?
Right.
So the Rebbeinu Shalom will give them Kores, but at the same time, the Besdin down below has the right to give them Malkus.
Thank you.
Okay.
Kuna, I appreciate that. Yeah.
Okay. Now, how about the business of Almona Kohen Gadol?
Right.
In other words, the Kohen Gadol is not allowed to marry a widow, but let's say he does. Or Gerusha v'chalutza the Kohen Hedyo, an ordinary Kohen is not allowed to marry either a divorcee or a woman who has received chalitza. Of course, what they don't mention over here is what we also learned, you know, that he's not allowed to marry a Gioris either. He's not allowed to marry a woman who has converted to Yiddishkeit. Yeah. So, at any rate... Huh? What, the Gioris? No, because the Gemara in Kedushin derived it from the fact, you know, that she might be considered like Isha Zedav Chalola, okay? That she's considered, you know, that in the former state she might have been considered as being impure or something like that, okay? a woman of loose morals, because the goyim did not necessarily have the same high standards of morality that a Jew is supposed to have. So that's the reason why they said that, okay? Even though, I mean, many of the Gioruses that we know actually are women, you know, with the finest reputation, but this became a blanket rule that any Gioris is not allowed to marry a coin.
Mm.
Okay? Mamzeres or Nesina?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Mamzeres we know, in other words, a woman who is, you know, she is a bastard according to the Jewish law. In other words, she's the product of an incestuous marriage, okay? When it's Sino, or if she is, let's say, a member of the Kuthis, remember the Kusim?
The Shomronim,
right. They cannot be married to a Yisrael, and let's say Yisrael marries them, in that case, both of them get malchus, men and the woman. Or Bas Yisrael in the Sin, let's say a Jewish girl, you know, with good Yichus who marries in the Sin, or a Mamzer, okay, a Mamzer. Okay, so it says Amonu Grusha Chayov Nodeh Mishum Shnei Shemas. So the Mishnah now says that actually they have committed, in the case of the Amon and the Grusha, there are two violations that they have committed, therefore they're entitled to what? To get the Malkus twice, right? But Grusha V'Chalutza, if the woman is divorced or she is a woman who had received Chalitza, then in that case if the Kohen marries her, Einu Chayev Ela Mishum Achas B'Vad, he gets only one. Why? Because basically the two are compared to each other. The chalutza, the woman who has received chalitza from her husband, from the yavim, you know, from the brother-in-law, that's her husband's brother, it's sort of like being divorced.
Rejected.
Right. The ziko, so to speak. In other words, the special bond that exists between the two until the time that it is resolved, has now been severed, okay, as a result of the chalitza. So it's like tantamount to a divorce. What? Would the Kohen Gadol get malchus? Sure, if you do the wrong thing. Yeah, we got both. We got koris and malchus, okay? Give them both. What? No, he wouldn't get koris for the simple reason that he has not committed a law which the Torah itself says specifically that you get kores for. Kores is only for those things where in the Torah it says that that soul shall be cut off from Israel, okay? The pshat, okay, this applies to all the incestuous relations that you find, for example, in Parsha Achrei Moz, or that you find it in Parsha Emor, okay, where they have a recapitulation. Yeah, but anything else is not considered liable to Koris, except that there are two cases where if you are in violation of an affirmative commandment, there the Torah mentions only in two cases that Koris is the punishment. One is the failure to eat Korban Pesach. Actually, that wouldn't apply to us because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, okay? Because it's written over there, you know, so he stopped, you know, observing the Korban Pesach, then it's written V'nichvasa Nefshahi, right? Or V'nichvasa Yishahu, and so on, okay? The other cases, of course, with Mila. If a person refuses to circumcise his son,
right,
then he's, you know, he's punished with Koris, right?
These are Peshat or not?
Huh? That's mentioned in the Torah. It's not mentioned here. It's mentioned in the Torah.
Yeah,
it's
dharma.
For dying
childless. Some of the things that mention over there are review.
Extramural.
Okay.
Yeah.
Certain things. Not everything that's mentioned over there. What you have to do, look, you have to go again and take a look at two sedras. Okay. One of them is Parsha Achrei Moz, where you have a list of prohibited marriages, okay? And in some cases, I mean, the word koris is mentioned, but particularly in when you come to Kedoshim, there they have a recapitulation of prohibited things, and there The Kores is mentioned lots of times, and also the Aririm, in other words, the childlessness, okay, is mentioned also over there. So you have to go to the specific cases and see which are listed under one category and which are listed under a different category. So it's a good assignment. Go back and read the Chumash and see what it has to say. Okay.
Machmir Moshe, what else?
One of them is Machmir Moshe, and the next one is Kedosha.
Okay.
Yeah, the two sevens, one after another. Because one explanation as to why Machmir Moshe followed by Kedosha, both of them dealing with a similar subject, is that in Machmir Moshe you have what we would call an Azhora. In other words, we have a warning that these are transgressions. Okay, and then in Kedoshim, when they are repeated with punishments mentioned, so then specifically, if you violate, then this will be the punishment that you get. Okay,
yeah.
All right. So that'll be a good assignment for next time. All right. Let me just finish the Mishnah right over here,
right,
and we'll call it a night. Okay.
Right.
Other violations: Hatomei Shorachal Hakedush. Okay.
Right.
Somebody is in a state of impurity.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
I got you.
And he eats sacrificial food. Okay. Now it could be, you know, let's say a person, let's say brought shlomim, you know, which he's permitted to eat. He eats, you know, certain parts of the animal and so on. But he was impure when he came to the Beis Hamikdash in order to eat.
Didn't go to the mikveh.
Yeah, didn't go to the mikveh. Didn't count whatever time has to be. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Or even a kohen, the same thing would apply. A kohen who is tamei is not allowed to eat any sacrificial food either. Or this would even apply to truma, to challah, I mean, because these are, you know, he has to eat the matara, okay, in the state of purity. Or the habo'al hamikdash tamei. Let's say a person goes to the Beis Hamikdash. Alright, these are all different violations. The Torah says that allowed to eat any chalev. Okay, you know, chalev is the prohibited fat in the animal, not the shuman, the permitted, but the prohibited fat. The dam, or the blood, right, is not allowed to eat blood. The nosar, nosar in the sacrifices is that, let's say, a sacrifice is to be, let's say, only for a certain limited time that it can be eaten. If any food is left over, then automatically that food is doser. Let's say somebody then ate it, then in that case he would be guilty of violation.
It's almost like
pigle. Yeah, there's a similarity. All right. Now, if pigol is more particularly here, it's being technical. Gemara in Zvachim speaks about the idea of what is pigol. So it says, if the kohen, for example, at the time that he slaughters the animal, you know, he brings the dam, the blood, and so on, his bayach, and so on. If at that particular time he didn't have the right machshava, the right intention, okay, then that becomes pigle. Or they speak about other possibilities.
Are you
sacrifices.
Are you talking about intention as far as time wise?
Well, okay, I'm coming to it. It could be a mistake. I mean, he thought that maybe, you know, it was shlomim and instead it was chatos or something like that. Okay.
This is before the sprinkling.
Huh?
Before the sprinkling.
Yeah, but you know he does it, and you know he did not have the right intention. Okay. So then, in that particular case, this is pigle. Other cases of pigle, as we say, chutz mizmano and chutz mimkoymei. In other words, that the slaughtering took place at the wrong time, or that it took place not in the right place where it was supposed to take place. Yeah. So all that constitutes pigle. Now, if a person eats pigle, right, then in that case, he's going to get malchus. The same thing, but he's nosar or dam or chelev. Okay. Vitome? Yeah, or if he eats, you know, unclean food. Okay? Or the hashoichet, umale bachutz, right? Or somebody slaughters, but where does he then offer up the sacrifice? outside of the precincts of the Beis HaMikdash, not in the right spot. It doesn't make it to the Mizbeach, it does it someplace else, okay? Or V'oichel chometz bePesach, somebody eats chometz on Pesach, that's obvious, okay? Or V'oichel, somebody who eats V'ho'esa melacha, or who does melacha V'yom HaKippurim on Yom Kippur, right? Or V'hamfateh mes HaShemen,
this
either he works on Yom Kippur or he eats on Yom Kippur. Okay? Yeah. Or v'hamafateh mes HaShemen, a person makes the oil, you know, along the same lines that the oil, you know, the Shemen HaMishcho, the Shemen that was used in the Beis HaMikdash, you know, was there. And he uses it for his own purpose. Understand? Yeah, it makes exactly the same concoction as it's written in the Torah. Okay? Or v'hamafateh mes haktoris. Same thing, he does the same with incense. Okay? Or v'hasoch b'shemen ha-mishcho. The shemen ha-mishcho was used in order to anoint the various parts of the Mishkan, and also to anoint Aaron and his sons and make them kohanim, and that also applied to their garments and everything else and so on. And this guy takes the Shemen HaMishcho and he uses it in order to smear it on himself. Okay? The Ho'echel Nevelos. The person eats the Nevelos. What's the Nevela? Nevela means that the animal was not slaughtered correctly. Yeah, it wasn't slaughtered correctly. Utrefus. Trefus means that the animal suffered from a defect on the inside, which makes a trefus. Okay? Of course, we use the word trefus in general to apply to all this, but in reality, there is a technical distinction between the Velas and Trefus, okay? Yeah, well, everything. Frankincense is only, you know, one component, okay? Yeah, everything that's involved in it, right. He makes it exactly according to the formula that was used in order to make it. Yeah, right.
Okay.
Or he eats shkotzim or mosim. You know, shkotzim, this is, you know, anything that's a loathsome thing.
Yeah, like
or mosim, all kinds of creeping things that he eats, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Ochal tevel. And what if he ate tevel? Tevel is food in Eretz Yisrael from which the tithes were not taken. Okay? Umay sarisha shle nitla tubose. Or Maaser Rishon, which had to be given to the Levi, as we said, and the Truma was not taken from it to give to the Kohen. Or Maaser Sheni, or the Hekdesh, or if it's Hekdesh, Shalei Niftu, you know, that they had not been redeemed from the state of being holy. Yeah, but the second party also, right? Yeah, I mean, but this has nothing to do, right? This has nothing to do with the Maaser Sheni and Hekdesh. You're talking again about the other one, the Maaser Rishon. All right, but that applies to the Kohen, for example. It applies to the Levi. Okay, if the Truma was not taken to give to the Kohen from it, then in that case, the Levi should also not eat. Understand? And needless to say, Yisrael certainly is not allowed to eat it because this is something that is holy and has to give. Right. But let's say Maaser Sheni, which the Yisrael eats in Yerushalayim, but he never took the trouble to redeem it so that it could be eaten, you know, back home. Mm-hmm. Let's say back home he eats what should have been brought to Yerushalayim as Maaser Sheni. Okay? Until he redeemed it. He didn't do it. The same thing with Hekdesh, that he used Hekdesh, which had not been redeemed, he has to redeem it.
You know, being subject to malchus, yeah.
So, right. So in that case, you know, then they would be subject to malchus. The question is, kama yochal min ha-tevel yehechayot, how much can he eat from tevel in order to become liable to malchus? So the answer is, Rabbi Shimon Neymer, kol shehu, whatever, even the minutest quantity, if you eat tevel. But the sages say, kezayis. It has to be at least
a kezias.
Size
of an olive oil.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't say unkosher. I said that the tithes had not been taken from it. You know, Truma, Smyswiss, these had not been taken. you know, that's a subject. There are foods in Eretz Israel that are subject to these things. Outside Eretz Israel, they're not subject, except if you import it from Eretz Israel. Okay? That's why you have to take a look and see what does it say on foods that come from Eretz Israel. And you have to know also, what year is it? Is it, was it just, you know, was it grown, let's say, during the year of Shemitah in Eretz Israel? Or have several years elapsed and then there's no possibility, you know, of this having been kept for so long. You understand?
That's still fancy.
Huh?
That's still fancy.
Yeah, it stands, absolutely. People who are very careful in Eretz Israel, they observe it. There is, I mean, there are such things as heteros, but even, you know, people who apply the heter in order to make sure that people are not going to sin and transgress. But nevertheless, in themselves, they will not violate it, okay? They're stricter with themselves than they will be with the public in general, okay? Omalai and Rabbi Shimon, so Rabbi Shimon said to them, hey, I say, you know, the slightest amount. Yatem odimli, don't you agree with me? Let's say if a person ate an ant, okay, a namala, that's an ant, even the minutest amount of ant, you know, he would be chayav, he would get malchus for it. So Amar lo, said to him, look, if neisha yikivriyasa, the reason being because it is a whole creature, okay, a bria. So he said, "No." So apchita achas kivriyasa. Even one grain of wheat is also like a whole thing. But needless to say, that while it's true with the ant, you're not allowed to eat it. But as far as the other one, you know how much makes tevel. So the law is that kazayas. But if you ate less than the kazayas, you would not be subject to malchus. Yeah. Okay,
so we're up to the Gemara.
Right, so we're up to the Gemara at the bottom of the page.
Yud Gimel?
Yeah.
Ahmed Aleph?
Ahmed Aleph, right.
And it's
we'll meet
the Yud Hashem
next Wednesday night, which is what, the 30th, 31st or something?
Today is the 24th, so
it'll
be
the 31st of
January.
Okay, it'll be the 7:30. Okay, Zadka Halagazun, have a good evening.
Gimel?
Yeah, on your Gimel. I'll tell you what I would like to do. I'd like to pay a little bit more attention to the Rashi of the Mishnah over there, because the Rashi makes certain points that we may have skipped over or something like that. So, and it's always good to review a Rashi. Mm-hmm. So we'll start with that first of all, with the Rashi that begins, you know, it says Elohim Halokin. All right?
The new
right. It's the Rashi on the Mishnah.
Right.
Then after that, we'll go into the Gemara, Mil Tasha. Okay? All right. So, Elay Nalokin. All right, so the first thing, naturally, is, you know, that these people are subject to Malchus, as it's written, right? So he says, Elay Lavdavka. So the first point that Rashi is making is that it isn't just these that are enumerated over here, but there are other offenses, too, for which you might possibly get Malchus as well. The Tana B'Shir, because the person, you know, who is the author of this particular Mishnah, he says he left out a lot of other things, okay? Lokin Tubar, I mean, there are plenty of other cases, says Rashi, where people would get Malchus. Elatona Chayve Krisis, so the question is, why does the Mishnah start first with those people who are subject to the penalty of Kores, right? So he says, Lashmin, this is in order to teach you something. And what is it? The Yesh Malchus B'Chayve Krisis, that Malchus will be the penalty administered for those who are also guilty of violating a commandment in the Torah for which the penalty is Kores. In other words, they can get both Kores, right, which is heaven, you know, the heavenly court will administer, and also Malchus, which the downstairs court will administer, okay?
The earthly court. Yeah.
Right. So then, after that, he goes into the business, you know, the business with the Kohen and the Kohen Gadol, right? He says, "Tana al mono ugrusha." Now, why did the Mishnah then speak about, you know, a Kohen Gadol who marries a widow? And of course, any Kohen or Kohen Gadol, wouldn't make any difference, you know, who marries a Gerusha. Why did they mention those? So he says, "La'ashmin inan." In order to teach you something else, what is it teaching us? He says, let's say the Kohen Gadol, he says, Almona Grusha. He married a woman who was widowed and also divorced. He marries a woman, but she'd already had previous experience. She was a widow from one husband, and she was divorced from another husband. So, what is the rebusa, we would say? In other words, what is the extra penalty or the extra teaching that we have over here? We're reviewing the Rashi right now. Okay, from the Rashi based on the Mishnah. So he says, Chayav Alech Mishum Shtei Shemes. He is going to be liable on two counts of violation. So in other words, how many malchus should he be getting?
Double.
He gets two sets, right. He gets a double set of malchus. Okay? So that two is a chiddush, because, you know, where you violate two separate, you know, things at a time, then you deserve
a double
penalty. Okay? Then after that it says, V'tana tevel ma'isa rishon, shel nitro tu ma'asei. He says, then he teaches about tevel, and Maisa Rishon, right? Remember, the Maisa Rishon is what has to be given to the Levi. But what does the Levi in turn have to do?
He has to
give to the Kohen, right?
Shenol
Nitra Tumasa, from which the Truma, in other words, that portion which should have been given to the Kohen has not been taken. So even though it's Maisa Rishon, you know, it's given over to the Levi, but the Levi himself will be in violation if he doesn't do what? Doesn't take the little portion that the Kohen should be getting out of it, right? The Lo Meforesh Lehu Ditu Behedya. It says, because these things are not really going to be explained in any great detail. Okay? The Chen Hekdesh Lo Nifta. And why then did they teach about Hekdesh? You know, that's what you give to the base Hamikdash, right? Which has not been redeemed. Remember, we spoke about that, you know, that if you want to dedicate something to the Beis HaMikdash, that becomes the property of the Beis HaMikdash. But what if you decide that you want to get it back again, which you have every right to do if that's what you want? Or anybody else, frankly, can do it too. I mean, if they decide, you know, let's say you don't want it anymore, but, you know, you're giving it its complete donation to the Beis HaMikdash, but somebody else, let's say, wants it. Not allowed to, you know, to do anything with it. You're not allowed until you do what? You have to redeem it from the temple treasury, and in addition, you know, to paying the value of the article, you also pay an additional chomesh, in other words, an additional 20%. Okay?
Service.
Yeah, well, in reality, it wasn't meant to be a service charge. Wasn't even meant to be a tax. It was meant to be actually an additional donation to the Beis HaMikdash. The whole idea of giving to Hekdesh is really that with your own heart, you feel that you want to enrich the temple treasury by giving something over there. I mean, naturally, if you gave a behema, so it all depends what kind. If it's a behema that's fit for the altar, then that cannot be redeemed. But if you give, let's say, a behema which is only good for plowing or something like that, well, let's say you decided to give a donation of a donkey or a horse or something like that. You understand? You're permitted to do it, but obviously they're not going to use it for a korban. Okay? But in turn, what can they do with it? Now, obviously, on the Temple Mount, they're not going to need any horses or donkeys over there.
They can use it.
Even though you still see Arabs coming with donkeys once in a while around the Kotel over there.
True, true.
But
they still have to have food, they still have to have other things. So
right. So if the Temple Treasury can sell it, you understand?
They can
sell it. Or another possibility, the Temple Treasury, let's say, owns lands because you permit it also to be makdish, in other words, to dedicate to the Beis HaMikdash land that you own, then in that particular case, I mean, maybe they'll need an animal in order to work there. So as long as everything over there belongs to the temple and is being done for the temple, it would be permissible. But if you, Mr. Layman, you go and take temple land and you decide you're going to plow it or something like that, or use a temple animal, and you do that, or whatever it may be, even if you took a spoon from the Beis HaMikdash.
Without compensation.
Right, then in that particular case, you have to pay the penalty. I mean, of course, I mean, if you want to redeem it, then as we already said, but what if you use it without, then in that case, this is Me'ila. In other words, it's called trespassing, okay? You're trespassing on the Beis HaMikdash, and this too is a lav. I mean, you're not allowed to do that. So, because of the fact that, you know, these are also lavim for which a person, you know, can receive malka. So this is the reason why they're mentioned over there. Okay? And then he continues. Let's see, what did I... let's go on. Yeah, continue. Okay. The Tanan Tevel Lamasa, Israel, Lamasa, Lamasa, before I start with you, right, Behedya, and I explained specifically, and then the Chin Hektish, Lamasa, right? All right. And the Ida, the Tanah Hektish, and inasmuch as already talking about Hektish, the Tanah Masa Shani, Behedya. So then he goes into somewhat greater detail concerning Masa Shani, and the Masa Shani, as we already explained, this is what he should take to Yerushalayim. Okay? But let's say, you know, let's say the fruit that he was going to take to Yerushalayim would not survive the trip, then in that particular case, what does he have to do? Before he gets to Yerushalayim, then he has to sell it, and the money is used to spend in Yerushalayim for food and sacrifice and things like that. Okay? All right. So the Tabayhu Malkos did do Mishubachuswe Pintiyo. So in the case of both what Hektish and also in the case of Maisha Sheni, which had not been redeemed, you get Malkus if you know you had not gone ahead and redeemed them the way they were supposed to. But Chaim Beruben says Rashi, yes, and likewise in the majority of the instances that are mentioned over here, Yesh Dovar Chadosh, she says there's something new added each time. In other words, it simply could have said Elohein Alokin, everyone who is Chayve Krisis, okay? Well, everyone who is Chayve Lavin. Again, let's distinguish between the two. Chayve Krisis, as I explained last week, means that the penalty of Koris is specifically mentioned in Torah for this particular
Avera.
Transgression. Avera, correct. Okay? And, you know, that most of it applies to the Aroyas, as we would say. In other words, to the various prohibited relationships that the Torah says you're not allowed to do, and the penalty for that is Koris, as we said. Okay? And then there are a couple of other little instances too where Koris is mentioned. As I told you, there are two cases, the only two in the entire Torah, where it is for an affirmative mitzvah that you should have observed and you didn't. One of them is Mila. In other words, you have a son, you're supposed to circumcise him. You don't do it, you are subject to Koris, right? Unless, you know, you go ahead and you finally fulfill it. But if you never circumcise, then in that case, you're liable to that. Or, during the days when the Beis HaMikdash was in existence and people went to Yerushalayim and ought to eat the Korban Pesach, so in that particular case, again, if you didn't participate in the mitzvah of Korban Pesach, then in that case also, it's written Nichus HaNef Shahi. Okay, that soul will be cut off. Okay. But primarily, Koris is mentioned in connection with the Aroyas. And then there's another case, of course, what's also mentioned in the Torah, namely, the person who eats and drinks on Yom Kippur. Kichol HaNefesh HaSher Lo Su'una, because any soul which is not afflicted by Yetzer HaYom HaZeh on that particular day, V'nichus HaNefesh Shahi, okay? And that's all. So there also penalty of Koris applies. Now, incidentally, you notice that there's a difference between the law concerning a violation of Shabbos. Naturally, we're talking about deliberate violation. We've been warned and this and that and everything else. And we're not talking about, you know, you didn't realize it was Shabbos, or you didn't know that this was prohibited on Shabbos and things like that. You understand?
By accident.
Right, yeah. It's only Shabbat, I mean. you can make mistakes about Shabbos. There's a Mishnah which it speaks about the laws of Shabbos as being like a great mountain. In other words, there's so many different possibilities, you know, for transgression of the Shabbos and so on. So that, you know, it's not easy to be 100% consistent, okay? There are times that something is going to happen without you wanting it to happen, you know, that it represents. So, the Shabbos, if you make a deliberate transgression, you know, in that particular case, and you've been warned and everything else, then of course the penalty theoretically would be the death penalty, okay? For Yom Kippur, it's not that. As I said, for Yom Kippur, we said that the penalty is Koris. And in general, I mean, where it says that the nefesh, the soul which is not afflicted on this day, v'nichrasa nefeshahi, usually they restrict it to the idea that you eat and drink on Yom Kippur. Now, of course, I'm not talking about children. I'm not talking about people who are very ill and who need a dispensation, because for them there is a dispensation. Dispensation, obviously, is that, it goes back again to what we read in the Torah and in Parsha Akrimos, where it says, Shayasa Isam Ha'adam, person is to do them, b'chai b'hem, and is to live by these Torahs, by the Torah's commandments. So, where it's a question, of saving a human life and something, then in that particular case, we are commanded to violate Shabbos, or we are commanded to violate Yom Kippur, if it's necessary to do so. But of course, you have to do so in consultation.
Oh, really? What exactly?
Well, it depends. Look, obviously, in emergencies, somebody gets hurt. And there's no question in that particular case. You don't wait for a rov in order to paskin, okay? Take him to the hospital. How many women give birth on Yom Kippur or give birth on Shabbos and things like that? There's no question. I mean, if you have to save a life, you do it. Right, absolutely. And not only that, but it's considered a mitzvah. Don't go around to a goy even to do it. Take it upon yourself in order to violate Shabbos, because you're not in violation of Shabbos in that case. You're helping, somebody through an emergency situation. It's a question of, saving a human life. Yeah.
What then is kores? I always associate kores from Shemayim as being death.
This is very difficult for me to pin down exactly.
Okay.
It means that the soul is cut off from the people of Israel. But what that means specifically, it means that the heavenly court will determine some kind of a punishment. It might mean, let's say, that they won't live so long. That's one possibility. It might mean that maybe, Koris is sort of related to another penalty called Misa B'dei Shemayim. In other words, death inflicted by the heavenly court, but not by the human court.
Well, would that be equivalent to being in Cherem or something?
No, Cherem is a different story.
Well, would they still accept his, sacrifices at the temple if he's subject to Koris?
If a person is subject to Koris, absolutely. Absolutely. Because as we'll see, one of the things about Koris is the fact that even though the heavenly court can decree Koris for somebody, but if a person does teshuva, then in that case, the heavenly court can be Michael. They can forgive the sin that has been. So there's no question.
So in other words, the judgment is strictly up to...
It's up to the revelation, right? The heavenly tribunal.
There's no judgment on by the earthly people.
No, not as far as Koris is concerned. But still, as we see from here, even though you're subject to Koris, but it doesn't mean that you can't get a good shmeis in the rear end, over your body.
Malchus,
right, yeah.
I have another question.
Yes.
This is sort of somewhat of a digression, but on the death penalty for Shabbat, are there any other instances where that was enforced besides at the time of Moshe? This is
not
a
that I know
that
of.
Comes from,
right. There are two cases in the Torah. One of them is the Mekoshesh.
Right.
And, that's the one as far as the penalty for Shabbos is concerned. The other one, is the person who blasphemed.
Right.
So that was not in connection with Shabbos. But the Mekoshesh is the only thing that's mentioned in the Torah.
Where is that?
A man who was found gathering sticks on the Shabbos, if you remember. Towards the end of Parsha Emor over there.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And they bring him to Moshe and he didn't know what to do with him. Right. What? You mean Salafchot? According to one interpretation, yes. Some say that when the daughters of Lafchot said, that Ovinu meis b'midbar, that our father died in the wilderness, he was not a member, he wasn't involved in Korah's conspiracy, so they say, then why did he die? So one explanation is, that he was the Mekoshesh. But it's a tradition, okay? Yeah.
So even though this is a penalty, it's supposedly applied by man.
Malchus is applied by man. Koris is not.
No, I meant the Mavet.
Yeah.
Mehaparat Hilchot Shabbat.
Yeah, right.
But it really was never.
Violation. Violation. Okay.
I have all this. Okay.
Lavor.
Lavor is fine. You have to forgive me. Here.
Yeah,
but,
that's okay. We don't forgive you.
Listen,
you're right.
I'm sure you're going to pass the test.
But what you're saying is actually. Yeah. As we would say, although it was on the books, it never was enforced. No one was ever put to death.
Not that I know
from
of.
From that point on.
Not that. Look, I can't say that there may not have been cases in history, but certainly they're not recorded. The only place where it's ever recorded in the Torah is simply the question of Mekoshesh, that's it. And, you know, that you might put in the category of what they call a Hiras Shoah, which means an emergency decree, simply in order to enforce the idea that Shabbos is not to be violated with impunity.
Thank you.
Unfortunately,
that was a good,
at times
people. Good term you used.
Okay, to continue with the Rashi. All right. Nesina. Who is this Nesina? So he says, Min HaGibonim. He says that she was a descendant of the Givonim. Right. Remember who the Givonim were?
Right.
The days of Yehoshua bin Nun. Okay? All of a sudden, a couple of guys come in to the camp of Israel and they say, we come from a faraway place and we want to make peace with the people of Israel. So, Yehoshua, the people of Israel were very happy to hear that, you know, people want to make peace with them and so on, and they didn't investigate any further, and they accepted it. Lo and behold, they go to start in to do the next, you know, conquering the next town. Lo and behold, they discovered that it's the same people with whom they made an agreement that they wouldn't do anything, you know, to harm them. But so the punishment for them for having deceived the people of Israel was that they were to be Chotvei Eitzim, the Shoavei Mayim. In other words, they were to be choppers of wood, okay, and drawers of water, okay, ewers of wood, as they say in the Old English translation, okay. And but as a result, the Gemara puts them in a class that, you know, they're below the Israelites, and they're not allowed to marry within the Israelite community, a full fledged member. I mean, this is what we learned in Kedushin, if you remember. And part of the reason being because who were the Givonim?
Yeah.
Givon was a town in Canaan, but the people who lived over there, essentially they were what we call Hachivi, the Chivites, okay? And of course remember, you know, that these were part of the Shiva Tzgoyim, you know, the seven Canaanite nations who were supposed to be you know, exterminated, and concerning whom the Torah has another pasuk that says what? Lois is katein bahem, right? Lois is katein bahem. So, in other words, they're not allowed to intermarry with them. And since,
well, the goyim,
right? So, what happened if? Well, they're not goyim either, because nominally they were Jews. Nominally they were Jews, but in Jewish history, we find in some of the later books of the Torah, the Tanakh, rather, I mean Torah, well, no, I say Torah in this case, music, then the broader sense.
All right,
but in the later books of the Tanakh, we find that, for example, the time of Ezra, Nehemiah, and so on, these Givonim made a lot of tzoras for the Jewish people, just as the Shomronim made loads of tzoras for the Jewish people. And that's the reason why they, you know, that they felt that you couldn't trust them and don't marry with them. That's all there is to it. So the point that Rashi is making over here, he says that, you know, Malkus, why do you get Malkus? He says, Mishum Laisis Chatim Bon, because you're violating the commandment that says you're not allowed to intermarry with them. Now, how about Almonor Grushot? So he says, here is the case, you know, why does the Kohen Gadol, who marries a woman who has been both an Almona and a Grusha, why does he get Malkus, a double portion of Malkus? He says, Amona Grusha session is Almanor me Ishachod. In other words, she was widowed from one man, Venizgarsha me Ishacher, and then she was divorced by another man. So he says, Chayav Alechu Shtei Malkus. He gets two Malkus penalties, Mishum Shtei Shemos, because he has violated two different categories. Mishum Shtei Ashoros, because of two different warnings given in the Torah not to violate them. Shteihem neforashos b'mikra, right? Both of them are specifically mentioned in the Torah. I mean, the Torah says that you're not allowed to marry a grusha. That, as we said, is for any kohen; wouldn't make any difference. And then the kohen gadol, in addition, is not allowed to marry an almana. Okay. The Ashora Tavayu Kaima, and the Ashora, in other words, the warning that they're going to be punished with Malkus, is in reference to both of these penalties, okay? Both of these violations. Gerusha v'chalutzo, and how about an ordinary coin? You know, if, okay, he's punished if he marries either a divorcee or a woman who, as we said, has received chalitza after the death of you know, her husband, and the brother then gave a chalitza. Okay, over there the story is because grusha, right, the he chalitza eino chayev aleho. Let's say the woman was both a divorcee and also a chalitza. In other words, she had also received chalitza. So he says in her case the kohen would only receive eino chayev aleho el mishum grusha. Okay, he would only receive the penalty of Malkus because he had married a divorcee. The she'achalutza eino ksuba, because the Torah nowhere mentions that a kohen is not allowed to marry a woman who had received chalitza. Doesn't say that. So how do we know he's not allowed to do it? The answer is the chachamim came along and they did it. Elo mirebuyo, right? It was something that was added as a result of, what shall we say, you know, by the logic of the situation, so to speak, they added the chalutza to the grusha as being women who are not allowed, you know, for the kohen, and not allowed to marry. And of course, I mentioned last week that a third one that we have to remember, he's not allowed to marry. He's not allowed to marry either, you know, a Gioris. He's not allowed to marry a woman who has converted to Yiddishkeit. She was born a goy, and he's not allowed to marry her. Okay. He says, my sin-in-law says, we bring this in, the Tanya B'Kedushin, as we learned in Kedushin, that Gerusha, right, a divorcee, Ein Liyele Gerusha, right, this applies to a woman who has been divorced. Chalutza Minayin, how do I know that if he marries a woman who has received Chalitza, that also the kohen is violating a law? It says Talmud Lema, because the Torah uses the word v'isha. It's written over there, isha zona v'chalala lo yikocho v'isha gerusha me'isha lo yikocho. Okay? Kohen is not allowed to marry. So the question is, why does it add, you know, v'isha gerusha? Because the answer is that any woman who would be somewhat like a gerusha would fall into the same category. And that's the reason why the woman who has received chalitza or the gioris, actually the gioris is based on the first one, isha zin v'chalolo, because they say, you know, that I mentioned last week that on Gemara Kedushin, that they are afraid that since goyim are brought up to a certain extent with a different set of ethical principles as far as, let's say, guarding virginity is concerned and so on. Particularly, we see it today in this promiscuous society in which we are living, right? Where, I mean, they seem to tumble into bed at the slightest, whatever it may be, the slightest excitement, right? So, you know, for that reason, they felt that even though, you know, now this woman, you know, has converted to Yiddishkeit, but for a kohen, it's not proper. For a Yisrael, yes, it's pasnish for a kohen, okay. Because a kohen has to be in a higher state of Kedusha, okay? And how about now, Tomei Shavokal HaSakadosh, in other words, the person who is unclean and who ate holy food, says, Asorasoma Foresh B'Gemara. Gemara will explain that. Nosar, that remember refers to a sacrifice where the flesh of the sacrifice is still around after the time that it should have already been consumed by the participants, right? So Siv Bey, it's written over there in the Torah, it says, V'soraftes hanosa bo'esh lo yeyocheil ki kodeshu, that you are to burn whatever is left over in fire. It may not be eaten because it is holy food. right? So therefore we see over there that, you know, there's no question, I mean, that that is prohibited, and therefore if you violate Pigul, then in that particular case you get Malkus, okay? The Asoras, if you violate the Dosa, the Asoras Pigul, as I explained to you last week, Pigul means that at the time when the slaughtering takes place, you don't have the proper Kavoda. The Kohen is not thinking properly. In other words, he thinks that it's a different type of a sacrifice. Or Pigul means that maybe he had in mind that he was going to eat it after the time that the Torah says it cannot be eaten anymore. Let's say it's a sacrifice that is Yom V'Laila Ad Chatzos, okay? Yom V'Laila Ad Chatzos is a sacrifice that has to be eaten that day, and it could be eaten the same night that follows the day until midnight, and after that it could not be eaten anymore, okay? So what if you had an intention not to say, well, I'll eat it tonight and I'll be able to eat it tomorrow morning? Because there are certain other sacrifices where it is Shnei Yomim V'Laila Echad. You understand? Where you have one intervening night, but you are permitted to eat it during the day, you know, in which the sacrifice took place, and also the following day. So let's say you mistakenly decided that this was the kind of a sacrifice that you could eat within the space of 2 days, when it could only be eaten within the space of 1 day. In that case, it's pigul. It's no good. You have to burn it. You're not allowed to eat it. If you eat it, you're in violation of a law. Okay?
Sort of overdue in a way.
Yeah, right. So it's vasoros pigul nami mehocha dechsev, from, you know, a pasuk where it's written ki kodeshu, right, that it is holy. Kloma b'neshu kodesh, because it is kodesh, right? Shenifsal, and then it has become posel. So the madna mikan, from this we learn kol shabbat kodesh posel, anything that was holy and then became posel. So the pasuk comes in order to teach us that you're not allowed to eat it once it's past it, you know, it has been it's lost its kedusha, right? And this is what we'll be saying later on. The Atzoras Tome, and as far as the prohibition that a person who is Tome is he's unclean, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe let's say he had a seminal emission, all right? Or he came in contact with a dead body or something like that, and then he goes into the Beis HaMikdash without having first undergone the purification, you know, going in the mikveh, waiting the proper time, and so on and so forth. So that he's in violation. So this we derive from a pasuk which says v'habosa asher yiga v'chol tome lo yoyochel, right? That any of the meat of the sacrifices, this is what the pasuk is referring to over here, which touches anything which is unclean, it could be anybody or anything unclean, makes no difference, right? Then lo yoyochel, it may not be okay. And if you eat it, then in that case it's a violation. Okay, now he goes into v'ashoichet. We're talking about a person who slaughters kodoshim bachutz, right? He slaughters sacred sacrifices where? Outside of the temple precinct, where he's supposed to sacrifice it, okay? That is supposed to slaughter it. In other words, the slaughtering too should be done in the Beis HaMikdash. Because what happens? Slaughter it in the Beis HaMikdash, then the Kohen receives the blood in a vessel, right? And what does he do with the blood? He has to bring it over to the altar, the Mizbeach, right? And then he has to pour it. I mean, some of it he sprinkles on the corners of the altar, right? And the rest of it he pours out at the foundation. They had, you know, like a little trench or something. Either it went sank into the earth, or there was like a little trench that carried it out, okay? But that's the Yesod HaMizbeach, okay? Again, if we would say some of these things would be a little bit clearer to us, particularly if we have a good commentary on it or a good translation, you know. But you know, it's not just to say all these words without knowing what we're saying. No,
well, it was plain it.
Right, okay. So this is why, you know, we say every morning, you know, about Eladvam, Shodomecha Perseyem, Boyle Mazer, Kang Yasodio Mabo, etc., etc., right? Kibrobaim, Midas Hasod, Vashka, Misam Jos, right? And so on. One of the things that we mention over there is also Iyun Tefillah. Now, what is Iyun Tefillah? The idea is that when you daven, you should think about what you say. Look into it and think about what you say. Okay? This is Iyun Tefillah. I mean, just the rattle to see how fast you can go through the davening, you know. It's not the right way to daven. I'm not saying that you don't, you know, that you're committing an avera. After all, you're still davening. But at the same time, there's quite a difference between how you daven and, you know, what the davening should be.
You don't get full credit for it.
Well, let's put it this way. I'm not in the credit business, okay? But I feel, you know, that we should do a little bit thinking about what we're doing and what we're saying. It should have more meaning to us. It shouldn't simply be, you know, a mechanical performance. Yeah, right. Okay, so the person who slaughters kochim outside of the temple precincts, or hamale kadoshim b'chutz, or if he offers up, you know, he burns the sacrifice, you know, outside of the temple precinct. So, atzoras male shomelecho penta'ale. So the warning given in the Torah of a ma'ale, that is of a person who is offering up a sacrifice improperly, is based on a pasuk. It's a pasuk that we find in Parsha Re'eh. It says over there, shomelecho penta'ale lesecho. Right, be careful not to offer up your sacrifices b'chol mokem asher, you know, asher talek, in any place that you decide that you want to do it. There was a time, if you remember, we had three stages. Stage number one was mentioned in Sefer Vayikra, Parsha Achrimos, namely that when there was the Mishkan in the wilderness, then the only place in which you could bring a sacrifice was to the Mishkan. That's it. Okay? Then, once the people of Israel settled in Eretz Yisrael, but before the building of the Beis HaMikdash, then a different situation prevailed. And that was what they called a Bama. Means that they would set up an altar, usually on some high place or something like that, but it was permitted anywhere because they are not being a central sanctuary in those days. I mean, it's true that at that time you did have a Mishkan in Shiloh, for example. Mm-hmm. It is true that, you know, afterwards, let's say there were some other places that it wandered to, right? But nevertheless, you didn't have a centrally recognized place that was approved by the Rebbe of Shalalem. Okay, so in that case, then you could offer up your sacrifices anywhere. Okay, but what happened once the Beis HaMikdash was built? Then in that case, if you wanted to offer up a sacrifice, then you had to bring it to Yerushalayim, to the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah, well, you had to take it over there. Okay, of course. I mean, the Kohen had to officiate it. The Shechita could be done even by somebody who is not a Kohen. Yeah, Shechita Ksheira. This is a principle that we have in Gemara Mitzvachim and other places, okay? But from the moment of Shechita on, then everything else connected with sacrifices had to be done by Kohanim. Until the point, you know, as I said, you know, that the sacrifice was burnt on the altar, depending, of course, what parts we're talking about, because not every sacrifice was the entire animal consumed. That was only for an ola. But some other things, you know, you would sacrifice certain parts of the animal, you would burn it on the altar, and then the rest of it could be eaten, either like, for example, in the case of a chatas anoshim by the kohen, or...